My favorite movies are the ones I can watch over and over and over and over again.
Yeah,
You
absolutely.
won't find probably many Oscar winners in my top 10. I just, of course, I appreciate, as an artist, I appreciate the filmmaking, the cinematography, the direction, all those things that are involved in making movies. But when you ask me to put my, if you ask me my top 10 films, they're all just movies that when they're on TV, you gotta watch. Or you can put them on at any time and just watch it all the way through and
That's
never get
it.
sick of them.
Welcome to My Movie Story. I'm your host, Brian McAleer. This is the podcast where we dive into the movies that have shaped us. Each episode, we sit down with a special guest to discuss their all-time favorite film, the movie that changed their life, and the one film they think everyone needs to see. Get ready as we journey through the cinematic worlds that make us who we are. This is My Movie Story. My guest today is Paul Carganilla. Paul is an award-winning actor, screenwriter, and filmmaker, and he is the father of actors Everly and Noah Carganilla. Paul was born and raised in Southern California and began working for the Walt Disney Company in 2005 as an actor, MC, and improvisational comedian. Paul has written, produced, directed, and acted in many web, film, live, on-stage, and live-streamed creative ventures. And in 2023, Paul launched CovePod, the Carganilla Online Variety Entertainment Podcast. Now, here's our interview with Paul. And welcome to My Movie Story, Paul. How are you today?
I'm wonderful, excited to be here. Thank you so much for having me, Brian.
Oh, it's a pleasure. It's a pleasure. And I know with our sort of different schedules and very different time zones, we've been really trying to make this happen for a while, and we've had all these things come up, but we're finally here, which is fantastic, because I've been really looking forward to chatting with you and about your three films and your background and your knowledge of film and all of that. So it's going to be great. And you've also got a podcast yourself. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
I do, yes. So it's called the Carganilla Online Variety Entertainment Podcast, or for short, Cove Pod, COVEPOD. And yeah, it's a weekly podcast. We feature creators. I'm all about inspiring and entertaining. So it's like a grab bag. It's like a box of chocolates every week. You don't know what it's going to be. Sometimes I have my friends on and we play music live, or I'll have a special guest interview. I've interviewed all kinds of creators, artists, filmmakers,
Cool.
authors. And we just talk about, what keeps people going, what keeps the creative flame lit. And we'll feature, of course, their work to share it with our audience. But yeah,
Awesome.
it's just a jambalaya of entertainment
Yeah.
for your weekly podcast queue.
Awesome. Awesome. Sounds like a real good sort of mix of guests and different content as well. And I've seen a few of your episodes where you get out the guitar and stuff, and from those watching this video episode, there's some instruments there in the background. So, yeah, you multi-instrumentalist, are you? Piano, keyboard,
Well,
guitar.
I grew up playing trumpet, but it wasn't until COVID that I picked up the guitar.
Oh,
We
right. Yeah.
found this thing before COVID. So I mainly came from an acting and filmmaking background, and my friends and I would do this variety show where it just came from a fluke. Like one day my friends and I were like, we would like to try stand-up comedy, but we don't want to go to an open mic night in some seedy bar in West Valley, LA. We want to be surrounded by love and encouragement, because these open mic nights for stand-up comedy can be really intimidating and really awful for your ego, especially.
Right. Tough crowds, huh?
But so we put something out on Facebook. We said, we're gonna get together and try new stuff creatively, and come join us in this dance studio. Bring your lawn chairs and your dinner and your beers and watch us try these new things. And that blossomed into a series of shows. People wanted more, and we called it Polly's Picnic. And we did about 20 shows over a 3-year span, I should say. And then COVID hit.
Of
And
course.
we figured out, because some of my friends are like brilliant with technology, that we could still do these shows online over Zoom. So we started these weekly things. They were called Polly's Online Variety Show. And it was every Saturday night during COVID. And we would have audiences of like 300 or 400 people in the live YouTube
Wow.
chat. Everybody looking forward to Saturday night and getting together in the live chat to watch this entertainment. And it branched off into this crazy thing where we were doing like musicals. We were doing Wicked and Les Mis and all these things live over Zoom. And along the way, my wife had gotten me a ukulele for Father's Day in 2020. And so I started messing around on that, and then that turned into guitar. And
right.
Then I had to have a collection of guitars, of course. So, but it was a really cool thing to be able to still entertain for a live audience over the internet during COVID and kind of just keep it going. Like, and sometimes on my podcast, we'll just get my friends together on Zoom and we'll play our favorite songs. And
it's great.
It's been fun.
Fantastic. Yeah. Well, what a great way to sort of just innovate and use that online space, because we were all forced into that, obviously, with COVID, and to do something really positive like that, that people were looking forward to. That's fantastic. Yeah. And I'm just curious if you can spot the instrument that's behind me, if you know what that's called.
The instrument behind you. Where I can see it in the room. Where is it? Can you point to it?
Can't see it. So just right there on top of the shelf. Can you see that?
Yeah, is that a, what do they call them, jarum?
It's called a boran.
Boran, that's right, yes.
The Irish drum. So, yeah, which features actually in one of your films, which is sort of where the seed was planted for me from that film. I'm like, oh, I want to play a drum like that, because I have an Irish background as well. And it sits there for decorative purposes, but when I've got the house to myself, I'll pull it down and have a bit of a tap on it as well. So, but definitely not as committed as you, but you know,
I used to play one actually.
Oh, yeah.
at Disneyland. I for 15 years I worked as an entertainer, an improv comedian at Disneyland.
Very cool.
And one of my roles was I was a pirate, and it was when the Pirates of the Caribbean movies were coming out, and movie number 2 and 3 were huge, and that's when they made this pirate band that would roam around the area in Adventureland by the ride. So we were like a 4 or 5 piece pirate band, and I would either be on the tambourine or the
boran.
Yes. And so, because I didn't play any of that, the band was like fiddle, guitar, penny whistle.
Oh, cool.
And all these different like things that they would have on pirate ships. And so I was mainly the improv comedy, keep the show going kind of guy. So they put a tambourine in my hand and a drum some days. And I played for years in Disneyland. Very fun.
Fantastic. Yeah. Well, really interesting background of experience you've got there. And I know you've got a background in filmmaking, which I think, you know, that'll pop up when we talk about one of your other films as well. So your 3 films, and I'm going to get you to introduce them each as we go along. And I thought we might start with the film that you consider to be your all-time favorite. This was a big film from back in 2001, I believe it was. Also a remake with a bit of a star-studded cast. So if anyone's trying to guess what it is, those are my clues, but I won't spoil it. This is your film. So yeah, go ahead, Paul. Tell us what is your number one, or one of your number one favorite films of all time.
I'll keep laying down clues for you. I was growing up a huge fan of the genre of jazz and big bands, and I loved Frank Sinatra, Dean Martin, the Rat Pack. And so as I, you know, then fell in love with films, music was my first love, and then films were my second. Of course, I would watch as many Frank Sinatra or Rat Pack movies as I could, and I loved the original Ocean's 11.
Now they tell me that I paid my debt to society.
Funny, I never got a check.
Scared? You suicidal?
Congratulations, you're a dead man.
He'll kill you. And then he'll go to work on you.
Someone call for a doctor?
Here comes a girl.
You're a thief and a liar.
I only lied about being a thief.
Why do this? Because the house always wins. Unless, when that perfect hand comes along, you bet big, and then you take the house.
Been practicing this speech, haven't you?
A little bit. Did I rush it? Felt like I rushed it.
No, it was good. I liked it.
But when I heard there was a remake coming out, I just, I was so excited because Steven Soderbergh is one of my favorite directors of all time.
Yep.
George Clooney and Matt Damon are two of my favorite actors of all time. And I just found out they were attached to it and yep. I couldn't wait. And then yep. I went to the theater, we saw it. And for me, I'll just lay this down at the top of the episode. For me, my favorite movies are the ones I can watch over and over and over and over again.
Yeah,
you won't find probably many Oscar winners in my top 10. I appreciate, as an artist, I appreciate the filmmaking, the cinematography, the direction, all those things that are involved in making movies.
Mm.
But when you ask me to put my top 10 films, they're all just movies that when they're on TV, you got to watch.
Yeah.
Or you can put them on at any time and just watch it all the way through and never get sick of them. The screenplay of Ocean's 11, I'm a self-taught screenwriter myself. And I just appreciate so much the snappiness of the dialogue, the creativity in it, and just, as you know, going into it, it's a heist movie. It's just, yep. it's going to be fun.
Yeah.
Don't expect too much, mm-hmm. but I think the writing is some of the best I've ever seen as far as the dialogue goes.
100%.
And the way that the actors carry it out, the chemistry between Clooney and Julia Roberts or Clooney and Pitt, it's just brilliant. And there's I couldn't pick a favorite scene from the movie because every scene that comes on, it's like, oh, good, this scene's on. You know what I mean?
Yeah, that's what the film did so well, because obviously it's not necessarily a remake of the first film, but kind of an adaptation of that idea where you've got this cast of ecllectic characters all played by these famous charismatic people. And then back in the day, you're Frank Sinatra, Sammy Davis Jr., those guys who were the world was watching them. And then, Ocean's 11 came along at a time where films were sort of transitioning. You had Steven Soderbergh, this up-and-coming director. And from my point of view, I think it captured all of those actors really at their peak in a lot of ways. You know, Brad Pitt had been around for a while, so Julia Roberts, and she'd had this sort of career renaissance through My Best Friend's Wedding. And then in the 3 years before that, Clooney and Damon had started to kind of break into movies. And they all just sort of came together and they all had this chemistry. So it wasn't like anyone was kind of competing with each other. You know, they all worked together really well. Yeah, what was your take on that, on the cast? And could you see anyone else maybe in this film aside from who was in there?
I don't know that I don't think I would want to.
Yeah.
I've heard them say, the reason they made a sequel in Ocean's 12 is horrible, in my opinion.
Yeah, yeah.
But they said in interviews, they'd never had so much fun on set with each other, with mm-hmm. a cast. And you can see that. It comes through when you watch the movie. It's just this is a group of actors and filmmakers that love being around each other, love encouraging each other and just playing and having fun. And it comes across every scene, every note. You mentioned Soderbergh was coming up and changing things, his use of color and tone with the music, yep. musical choices he picked, along with the screenwriting that I already mentioned. It all just is so perfect. And mm-hmm. one of the ending scenes is one of my favorite, probably my favorite piece of music in the universe is Claire de Lune. For them, for Soderbergh to put that with the Bellagio after the heist and they're all saying goodbye, and it's just a beautiful moment. I mean,
it was, wasn't it? Yeah.
If you haven't seen the movie, I'm not spoiling anything. It's a heist movie. They steal something and they're
exactly
they get away with it. But
yeah, they're basically so criminals, but you like them. They're very likable. And it was sort of part of that change in films where it was focusing on the bad guys, and it's like, hey, the bad guys can win, but the bad guys aren't really bad guys. They're good guys. They're just, they just want to have a bit of fun and not have to work in a crappy job. And the actual villain of the film, I guess, was the guy who owned the casino, who was a douchebag. But yeah, I thought it was, and I agree with you, that ending scene where they're all just watching the fountain, that made me want to go to Las Vegas. That film and that scene, I'm like, I have to go and just stand there and watch this fountain and imagine hearing that music in my head. And each time I've been to Vegas, I do that. And I think of Ocean's 11. It's impossible not to, really, isn't it?
Really? Yeah. And just, you know, I had never, I didn't really grow up with like the Godfather or gangster movies. So I hadn't known Andy Garcia yet, but I knew he was like a seasoned actor, and he is just the perfect villain. And one of the tenets of screenwriting is, and writing a successful villain is, you want to write a villain that is the hero of his own movie. That if you flipped it around, you would say, you know, the world's against him and he's mm-hmm. doing the best for, and he is, like, you know, it's as old as storytelling is, you know, having bad guys that are the hero. But and that is something that Quentin Tarantino is obviously very good at, Robert Rodriguez, yep. but to get the audience to root for the guys that are stealing his money,
yeah,
is a lot of fun. And I think that's
genius, yeah,
why, you know, Wicked does so well, and stories like that take mm-hmm. these villains mm. and write wonderful stories for them that let them flourish and let the audience see the other side and kind of root for them at the same time.
Yeah, it's interesting because it makes some, because traditionally in movies it was good guys versus bad guys, but then, you know, Ocean's 11 was sort of one of those films where the lines were being blurred, and it kind of, yeah, it plays with that idea, like, if you were in that situation, what would you do? Like, could you justify stealing money off of a guy like that? You know what I mean? And it's just a fun movie. It's just fun to kind of play around with that concept. And I have to ask, had you been to Vegas before you saw Ocean's 11?
I had been yep. out there a bunch. I had relatives that lived out in Vegas, and
oh, cool. yep.
so during my childhood, my uncle is a baseball scout, and he would facilitate a baseball camp, and we would go every winter out to Vegas. And so I remember before the Bellagio was there and all that, when I was an 8-9 year old kid, we'd drive down the strip, and the biggest sign would be the cowboy pointing his yep. thumb. But now yeah. it looks completely different. It is
absolutely
transformed like crazy. But yeah, mm. I had seen the Bellagio, I had seen been to all those hotels, and so it was really yep. cool. You know, anytime you can watch a movie that takes place somewhere you've been, you're mm-hmm. that much more like invested and involved in it. So definitely. yeah
and it uses the setting of Las Vegas so well, like, you know, like each casino is kind of like a character in itself, and it's that's the thing with Vegas. It's kind of like you go into Vegas and it's like this kind of insular world, because, you know, it's very smart how they design all the casinos. They're all sort of interconnected, so you can walk from one end of the strip to the other and only have to be outside for a few minutes at a time, which is handy because it gets bloody hot over there. Yes. The times I've been, like, we were melting. But yeah, you can just sort of get lost in that world of casinos and, you know, excess and exuberance and all that, and it's an amazing place. Do you have a favorite casino in Vegas that stands out for you?
I'm not a huge gambler, actually, but and I hadn't really been back. It's been like 12 years since I was there, but we went back this past summer. As you'll find in this episode, I'm a huge, we call ourselves Titaniacs. We're like obsessed with the Titanic, the movie and the history. But there's a Titanic convention every summer. And this year it was at the Luxor, which is the big pyramid casino.
Oh, yeah. Yep.
But they have a Titanic artifact exhibit there that has a ton of artifacts recovered off the seafloor from the Titanic itself. And ooh. They have what's called the big piece, which is an 11-ton piece of the hull, the side of the ship with windows and everything still in it.
Wow.
They raised from the ocean floor, and it's there. You can go see it and sit
That's
with
amazing.
It. But, so, yeah, I hadn't been back to Vegas until this past summer for over a decade, and it's just so crazy to see how quickly it grows, how quickly it changes, and mm. it doesn't like have a whole lot of room to spread out, so it's grown within itself, really.
Yep.
It,
yeah,
kind of just like built around itself. And so yeah, it was 108 degrees when we were there, but everything's connected unless you have to cross the street. But yeah,
yeah. Very cool. Yeah, well, I'll just quickly share. My first trip there was in 2003, so a couple of years after I saw Ocean's 11, and it was I did a Kentucky tour of the West Coast of America, and we finished up in Las Vegas,
And I was there with my sister. She sort of jumped on the tour with me at the last minute when she wanted to come on a holiday. I'm like, yeah, all right, tag along. And she bought us tickets to go and see Siegfried and Roy. Now, this was 2003, and we had tickets booked, paid for to go and see their famous show 2 weeks before our show was when the tiger attacked one of the guys and
Oh
nearly killed him.
no.
And then they stopped the show, and they've never done it again. And obviously, the tiger had to be put down, I think was the story. But yeah, we were meant to do that. And then that happened 2 weeks before we got there. But so we had this extra free night in Vegas, so we just kind of walked around, and which was fine because we'd had that booked, but there was nothing to do. And but yeah, it was great. So much to see, and yeah, it's a fun place, and a great setting for a heist movie like Ocean's 11. Yeah.
Everything is so spread out. You think, oh, it's a couple blocks, but it's miles.
Yeah,
It's a
it's massive.
mile long trek. We went when my brother turned 21. I guess it would have been the year 2000. We went to see a Britney Spears concert at the MGM for his birthday, and then my parents were like, "Our hotel's 2 blocks away. You can just walk back." And it ended up being like 3 miles.
Yeah.
We were pretty tired after that walk, but
Yeah, absolutely.
it was good.
It's bigger than you think, isn't it? Yeah, for sure. Yeah. So you briefly mentioned Ocean's 12, and I agree with you. That was nothing much to sing about. I've only watched it once. I'll probably never see it again.
It's
Ocean's
hard. It's
13, I
hard to
haven't
watch.
seen. Have you seen Ocean's 13?
I have, yeah. Ocean's 13, I think, is better. It comes back a little bit toward its roots, and
That's right. Yep.
Al Pacino's the bad guy. And I think, that kind of made up for the bad taste in your mouth from Ocean's 12. But and then they made one, Ocean's 9 or 11 or
Ocean's 8
10.
with all the
Ocean's
women.
8.
Yeah.
Yes, Sandra Bullock. That one was fun too. I
Yeah.
was hoping Clooney would pop in for a cameo on that one, but yeah, I mean, the other films are fine. 12 of course is rotten, but 13, 8, I guess are fine, but Ocean's 11 is really, in my opinion, just so much. Oh, I have to share. I collect VHS tapes
Oh,
that are
yeah.
sealed and unopened. You can see there's
Oh,
still
yes.
like
Wow. Yeah, hang on to them.
watermark on the shrink wrap. It's in a protective case. But I about a year and a half ago, I started to think, VHS tapes were a huge part of my childhood as a movie lover and a movie fan, and they're going extinct.
They are.
And so I hit eBay, and I was like, I gotta find all my favorites, still sealed, never opened. And so I got a couple of bookshelves full of my favorite movies, still in their original VHS
Yeah,
seals.
hang on to those because yeah, they're becoming collectibles now, and people love nostalgia, and they'll actually go and buy a VCR and watch these VHS tapes just for that sort of grainy, subdued color, not in high def or anything like that. Because yeah, it takes you back to the 90s when that was all we had, and we didn't know any better. And then DVD came along and changed the game. And yeah, I've actually somewhere behind me here, I've got a VHS tape of Freddy's Dead,
Oh,
A Nightmare on Elm Street 6, and it's got like this extra flap on the front cover, and it's got his claw marks in it and stuff. And yeah, I found that in an op shop years ago, so I'm going to hang on to that. That might be worth something one day as well.
yeah. Awesome. You
We'll
know, there's
see.
something to be said about physical media. My first job was in a drugstore photo lab, processing film from cameras and
Oh, yeah.
printing out prints and
Right, yep.
delivering them to people in an hour. But I gotta tell you this, sorry if this is going too far off track, but my wife and I, every holiday season around Christmas time, we like to go to New York City because it was where a lot of our first dates were and stuff like that. But we were there this past December, and we were walking through Central Park, and in Central Park they have vendors, selling paintings and photographs and touristy stuff. But the longest line that we saw was for this gentleman who had set up a location where he was taking people's photos with a Polaroid camera and charging $10 a photo. And people were like I said, it was the longest line we saw, and the whole line of vendors just lined up to take their photo with a Polaroid.
Yeah.
And it blew my mind. I was like, why? Because I know, because my daughter has a Polaroid camera, like, it's $20 for 10 shots. Mm-hmm. The roll of film is 10 shots and they're $20. So they're $2 a shot. So he's making $8 a picture. Like, yeah, he's killing it. And yeah, why? Smart. What is the reason that this line is so long? I think it's because of the just physical media. It's mm-hmm. become like, no longer is it, you know, something tangible that you can hold in your hand. It's
yeah,
crazy. Yeah. But so that's kind of why, like, having a VHS tape is like, oh, this is how I remember movies. This is how I got ready to enjoy it, to pop it in the VCR. But
absolutely. Yep.
Yeah.
And then have to, if you took it back to the video store and it wasn't rewound, you'd have to pay like the 50 cent fee or something like that. And if you'd rented 5 weekly videos, it didn't rewind any of them. $2.50, you know, for a teenager in 1999, that was a couple of bucks out of my wallet. But yeah, look, I agree with you. Like, that physical media seems to be sort of creeping back in, because not everything can be digital. You know, we want to touch and hold stuff. We want to feel it. Like, just even hard copy books, I've got tons still here in my study. And you know, I don't have a Kindle. I don't really read ebooks or anything like that. It's like I have to hold the book, you know. I guess I'm a bit old school that way, but 100%, I see where you're coming from. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm another one of my jobs. I called myself an industry killer growing up, because first I worked at the photo lab and my next job was at a music store where we sold CDs. And then my next job was at Blockbuster Video. So I was a manager at Blockbuster. So yeah, I remember the rewind fees and mm-hmm. how upset people would get when they drop off 4 tapes and they're all 2 hours late and they have to pay for another 2 days. And
yeah. Yeah, that's it.
Yeah, I think it's nostalgia, and it's also just part of cinema history, being able to own these things. And so that's why I love, like, someday, you know, when I'm gone and I'm passing these on to my kids, like, me, it's not even about the monetary value for me. It's just about, you know, the part of life that was enjoying these.
Absolutely. Yeah. We've got to protect that stuff for sure. Yeah. Cool. Well, Ocean's 11, you know, and Vegas, obviously, there's a close connection there, and we've talked about that and your love of the film. And yeah, it's for anyone who hasn't seen it, maybe some young people watching this podcast, definitely check it out. You can probably skip part the second one, Ocean's 12, like we've said, and then yeah, but the original is the best by far. All right, well, we might jump to your next film, Paul, if that's all right. And this is the one that you considered was sort of a game changer for you, you know, changed your perspective, changed your understanding, changed your life in some way. And I believe this is sort of tied to your filmmaking background. So yeah, please introduce that film for us. Tell us all about it.
When I was a freshman in high school, the movie came out, and I have the VHS right here for you. It's called Desperado, starring Antonio Banderas, directed by Robert Rodriguez. It was actually Selma Hayek's breakout role.
Let's play.
Desperado, the new film from Robert Rodriguez.
I remember hearing, because back then we had our family video camera, and I would make movies and I'd have to edit them with like 2 VCRs hooked up to each other, sometimes 3, and one is recording, and then I pause the recording and I play the other, and then I stop that and play it, and then I have an audio tape hooked up to it for the soundtrack. I was a indie filmmaker before I knew what indie filmmaking was. And around that time was when Robert Rodriguez came around, and I had heard that he made his place, self-made man in Hollywood, made his career, really kicked down the door with a really low budget independent film called El Mariachi that of course led to Desperado and then became a trilogy with the Once Upon a Time in Mexico.
That's right.
But he really showed young aspiring filmmakers that it's possible. And I remember I went to the movies and I saw the film, and it's fun. Is it a great movie? Did it win any Oscars? No, of course not. But like, just the stylistic filmmaking, the raw, unapologetic, like so many throwbacks to kind of old shoot 'em up movies.
Yep.
But also just his style. Like, there's the scene with Steve Buscemi in the bar, like,
yes,
just doing a what do you call it, foreshadowing.
Oh yeah,
monologue. Went great before scene. He comes in, and then the tension, you feel Cheech Marin's in there, I think, and a couple other actors, but like the old Hollywood, like Western drama tension that you feel in a lot of Tarantino movies, because Robert Rodriguez and Quentin Tarantino, they're very, they're friends, and they came from the kind of the same background.
Yep.
But I remember being in the theater, just being so drawn in and so connected to what was happening. And while I'm watching the film, you know, it wasn't normal. It was kind of pushing boundaries, and not a lot of, like, there weren't a lot of hints of modern polished filmmaking. It was just very unapologetically raw and telling the story that he wanted to tell, and not apologizing for it. And like, here's the story of Desperado. It really kind of lit a fire in me and just kind of showed me that, what I'm doing with my three VCRs here in the living room, this can turn into something.
Yeah.
And there's hope out there for independent creators everywhere. And so that kind of, like, I want to say, opened the door to my own independent filmmaking career. I ended up, you know, out of college, I mainly wanted to be an actor. And so I ended up, I mentioned earlier, with a 15-year career for the Disney parks as an improvisational actor. But during those years, I was learning filmmaking, and I was learning about the cameras and learning editing and producing. And that was the same time that YouTube was becoming a thing, and Facebook, where you could share your YouTube videos. And when I was growing up as a kid, I would spend so much time making these movies on these three VCRs that if I got 10 people in a room to watch it, that would be cool. But now I just put a YouTube link on my Facebook, and anybody can see it. So I, during that time, was kind of just developing this independent filmmaking hobby, I guess. But along the way, Kickstarter came around. I made some web series, some short films, until finally, like, I would say at the height of all of this, I was able to kickstart my own original feature film. So we raised $50,000. I made a movie in a week at a haunted hotel here locally, and it's called The Haunted Man. You can find it on my YouTube channel.
We'll share the link.
Cove Pod. But all of this, I would say, is because of this whole idea that was the seed that was planted from Robert Rodriguez and watching Desperado in high school.
Yeah.
Fast forward, if I may, to a couple of years ago, my daughter, I have two children now, and my daughter was cast. She's an actress. My children are actors, but she was cast in a Robert Rodriguez film called Spy Kids Armageddon.
Came out
this past September. And so, flashing back to high school me sitting in the theater being inspired by Robert Rodriguez, and fast forwarding to last summer being in his home, in his kitchen, he's making us dinner, telling us stories about my favorite actor on Benicio del Toro, sitting where I'm sitting, and watching, being that we spent the summer at his studios, Troublemaker Studios in Austin, Texas, and just watching this man direct and work with my daughter after he was the one that inspired me to get into the filmmaking to begin with.
Yeah, wow.
Was totally surreal.
Incredible. Totally surreal. Yeah, talk about coming full circle. Like, that's just, what a thrill. And, like, you know, I'm sure you would have had so many questions for him, and, like, he would have had so much to share with you. And yeah, seeing how, you know, you've been there with him from the start, really, from El Mariachi to Desperado to where he is now and all the big films he's made. That's incredible. Yeah. Yeah. Fantastic. And congratulations to your daughter as well for scoring a part in that film. That's very exciting.
Thank you. Yeah, it was really cool to be a part of.
Yeah, I can imagine. Yeah, really cool. So I do have to come back to the start of the film here, because Desperado, I think, is, like you said, for any up-and-coming amateur independent filmmaker, this is like film school contained in one movie. Because before Desperado was El Mariachi, which Robert Rodriguez made for something like $7,000, right? And he pulled it off, and it kind of introduced this world, and he elaborated on that with Desperado. And El Mariachi shows up in Desperado because they're actually part of the same like universe, right? If you like. But that opening scene, I just watched it recently before our chat today, I think is one of the best opening scenes of a movie I've ever seen. In terms of like the foreshadowing, setting up the feel and look of the film, hinting at who this protagonist is and the style of the action. And it's all done just through Steve Buscemi's dialogue. Like, it's just so well done. And you're hooked once you watch that scene. You're like, all right, I'm in. I want to see this guy come and shoot up all these, you know, criminals and Mexicans and just have this great time, you know. And then, yeah, the film just never really lets up. Yeah. So do you have like sort of any favorite scenes from the film in particular, or would it be that opening scene?
It could be. For me, it's mostly like shots. I do love like the tension that builds, like that opening scene you mentioned. You just feel the tension building and building and building to a payoff. And I think of a lot of Tarantino films that do the same thing. I think of Inglourious Bastards, the milk scene. I think that's the opening scene in that one too.
Yep.
And the Jewish family's hiding in the cellar, and the Jewish hunter guy is there, and just the tension, the palpable.
Oh yeah.
It's like you cut it with a knife, and like it's hard to do when you're making a movie. Yeah. But also like a lot of the shots in Desperado, there's a shot I remember after he's been shot up and he's just walking along a wall, and he's like leaning against the wall, and he's just smearing blood in his trail.
Yeah,
and like,
yeah,
the cool visual of that, but also just like that's a metaphor for him and his journey. Like he's on his way seeking revenge against the man who killed his lover, and he's just leaving blood in his wake. And like just that shot is a visual representation of this man's journey. Yeah. Like
very smart like, filmmaking, isn't it? Yeah.
I think he was probably one of the first directors who did the walking away from an explosion shot too. And that's in that movie where he and Salma Hayek are walking away from a building and it explodes. Like, a lot of amazing visuals, and just the way he just tells this story with such grit, and the rawness of it all is just so wonderful.
Absolutely. And the gunfights are just like second to none. Like the editing, and just like the way Antonio Banderas just immersed himself in that character, like the physicality, and it really, you know, that really made him a huge star. And then he scored the part in Zorro after that, and later on he shows up in Expendables 3, and he was fantastic in that. He was the best part of that film, I reckon. He just stole the show. Absolutely. And then you mentioned Tarantino before, and interestingly, Rodriguez and Tarantino got together for the first time and made From Dusk Till Dawn, which sort of the same kind of style of, you know, Desperado, and obviously the same director and all that. And great, another great film. Watching it for the first time, like pre-internet, no spoilers, no one was going to tell you like, hey, they're all actually vampires. It just starts off like this kidnap film, and then all of a sudden, boom, oh my God, there's vampires. What the hell? Like, it just completely flips on its head, but it pulls it off really well. Yeah.
I remember seeing, because I went into it knowing it was a vampire movie.
Oh, you
and
knew.
I remember sitting there like 20 minutes in going, this is not a vampire movie. And then at one point it just flips on its head, and it is. And they also teamed up after that. They made, there's a movie called Four Rooms, where it's about a bellhop in a hotel and his experience in four different rooms in this hotel. And they had it's kind of like a mixtape of a movie where they had different independent filmmakers direct scenes that this bellhop experiences in different rooms of the hotel.
Oh, okay.
And so Robert Rodriguez's room is a couple of parents who are getting ready to go out on the night, have a great night together, and they leave their son and daughter in the care of this bellhop. But Antonio Banderas also plays the father in that, and right. He wears a tuxedo and he's very slick back hair and a bottle of champagne. Fast, send it up. and so making that actual part of that film is what inspired Spy Kids eventually for Robert Rodriguez. He thought, I want to make a James Bond series with kids. Yep. And then Antonio Banderas, of course, went to be the father of the original Spy Kids trilogy.
Yep.
But you mentioned From Dusk Till Dawn, like I'll send you a photo, you can edit it into the video, but at Troublemaker Studio, Robert Rodriguez's studio in Austin, he has all of this memorabilia from his own films in this large meeting room. It's a huge meeting room with a big long table and chairs all along it, old like carved wooden chairs, but on the walls are pieces, props from his movies along the way, because he's a very sentimental filmmaker, so he saves a lot of stuff. And on the wall in that meeting room is one of the clapper boards from Dusk Till Dawn.
Oh, wow.
He has in the corner of the room, sitting in the corner, the guitar cases from Desperado that were machine guns and stuff like that.
Awesome.
He has the old guitar from Once Upon a Time in Mexico. Like, it's all just hanging out. And when you go to meetings and you sit down, you're just surrounded by the history of his films. And it's pretty,
very cool.
Pretty
amazing. Very cool. Oh, that would have been a great experience, and being a you know, such a fan of his and having him influence you so much, like to be in that room would have just been like, yeah, it would have been incredible. Yeah, what a story. Fantastic. All right, so far we've had Ocean's 11, Desperado, you know, really cool to hear the stories of your connection to Robert Rodriguez and getting to meet him, which is just really awesome. I'm very jealous. A few filmmakers I'd like to meet, but they don't come to Australia, so, you know, I'm not holding my breath, but that's okay. and now for your last film you want to talk about today, Paul, is the film that you think everyone must see. And there we go. Tell us all about it.
The Brick. The highest selling brick in VHS history, the 2-tape Titanic.
You have to stay on the ship as long as possible.
Everybody had the 2 tapes at one point, I think, but yeah, I mean, you can't, as far as favorite movies, something I can watch over and over and never turn off once it's on. Ocean's 11 and Titanic are my 1A and 1B. I think when I went to see, I had known about the Titanic, and my grandparents had a National Geographic subscription, and I remember being like 6 years old, sitting on their couch, opening the National Geographic when Titanic's wreckage was discovered by Robert Ballard and the team.
Yep.
And looking at the pictures of this ocean liner that had been underwater for 80 something years, and it captured my imagination back then. And then, of course, I was a fan of James Cameron films. The ones that I snuck out to see growing up. And when I found out he was making a Titanic movie, I went, of course, I think I was a sophomore in high school, maybe a junior, and my brother was working at the movie theater. So if some showings weren't sold out, I could just go in for free. And I saw it 10 times when it came out, because it just really grabbed me. And I think it was the scale, obviously the Titanic's place in history, but also the scale of filmmaking with which, you know, it's like at the opposite end of the spectrum with Robert Rodriguez movies that were very raw and dirty, and then you have this titanic epic, like $200 million budget thing that I argue today is probably the last epic before, you know, green screen and CGI came in. It's like really the last undertaking of this magnitude as far as making a movie went.
100%. Yeah. It was like, there was nothing like it up until that point, you know, and it broke all the records for that reason. You know, it was big film, big budget, big director, big star, set on a big ship, you know. it was just big from the beginning, right? And it was like, it was an experience from start to finish. Like the fact that they essentially built a ship and actually sunk it, you know, with all these actors and crew on it, was just, it was mesmerizing. Yeah. And it's still impactful for today, you know, and obviously special effects have come a long way, but like you said before, the green screen and CGI, where everything was, you know, seamless and perfect, but kind of overdone. This went back to just, you know, good old fashioned filmmaking with sets and stunt people. And yeah, it's incredible. And we'll assume most people have seen Titanic, and if they haven't, they've heard of it. You know, it had the spot of highest grossing film in the world until Avatar, which was by the same director, funnily enough. Yeah. So, tell us about, I guess, you mentioned you'd saw Titanic quite a few times. Do you remember the first time watching it, like how you sort of felt coming out of the theater and the impact that it had on you? Can you sort of capture that moment?
Yeah, it was. I remember it like it was yesterday. And the lights coming up and the soundtrack kicking in, the iconic with the old grainy videos of people waving as Titanic where it was leaving Southampton for its maiden voyage. I almost said final voyage, but that would have been right too. But
yeah, first and final, yeah.
The way that Cameron like juxtaposed this old footage that he created, that wasn't actually ancient footage, it was stuff that he shot with, and the way he was able to tell the story with old Rose in modern day, with the flashbacks, you know, you can nitpick so much about the movie, and you know, the love story, it is what it is, and James Cameron is the first to admit that he had to have a love story to get the movie made. He, of course, being such a Titanic enthusiast, he wanted to tell a Titanic story, but he didn't feel like something plucked from history would actually sell the tickets and get people to, you know, but buy their tickets and butts and seats.
Yep.
So his pitch when he pitched it was, it's Romeo and Juliet on the Titanic.
Yeah.
And so somebody had to die, and there's all the conversation about the panel and could they both fit on it, and he came out and said, like, he's been battling that for 25 years, and he just came out and said recently, he's like, listen guys, for the story someone had to die. Jack had to die.
It's a movie, yes.
And so it was all of the elements mixed with, like, it was the filmmaking, it was also the acting. Leonardo DiCaprio and Kate Winslet do fantastic jobs. And Cameron tells the story about how when he was casting the role of Jack, how Leo came to him and said, you know, I was talking to my team about it, and I'm really, you know, really my success comes from playing characters with a challenge. You know, coming up to that, he had played Gilbert Grape, and he had done these iconic roles where he was dealing with some sort of developmental or mental challenge. And so he brought that up to James Cameron, and Cameron was like, listen, this might be the hardest role you play because the guy is just a free spirit. He's like a ball of positivity and optimism. And DiCaprio would later end up saying, like, it was one of the most challenging roles he played because he didn't have a crutch to lean on. He had to play this role. So
yeah, he was kind of like the everyman, wasn't he? He was the hero of the film.
Just that whole artistic live on the wind kind of free spirit was a challenge for him because he had mm-hmm. never done anything like that before. But yep. I think yep. he and Kate's performances together were just wonderful.
Absolutely. Yeah. And he was sort of this teen heartthrob at the time and then made him like this mega star, and he disappeared for a few years and came back and did The Beach and then started working with Martin Scorsese for the next 20 years. And then, Kate Winslet, it was like, wow, Kate Winslet, she was just like this force of nature that sort of came out of nowhere, and it made her a huge star as well. And it like we said, it sort of broke all the records and held that place until James Cameron followed it up with Avatar and outgrossed his own film. Incredible effort, yeah.
Speaking of Kate, I have to share this with you and your audience. I
yes, please.
Also try and collect movie props and stuff on the right. side.
Okay.
Along with my VHS collection. But I actually, this was a gift from my wife for our anniversary last year. Do you remember the scene where Rose makes the decision to jump off the back of the ship?
Yep.
So she's running, and Jack's laying on the bench, and she stops at a capstan wheel and leans over it and catches her breath and then decides she's going to go jump off the,
right, yes. the ship.
My wife tracked down the actual wheel.
Oh, no way.
The movie production.
Wow.
And got it for me. And it That's hangs incredible. On the wall downstairs next to like a framed photo of the moment in the film and stuff. But when they finished making the movie, Fox thought the movie was going to flop. They trashed everything. They demoed the set and pushed it with bulldozers onto somebody's property. They didn't even ask if they could leave it there, and they left it there and went back to Hollywood. And so this farmer in Mexico was like, can somebody come get all this trash?
Yeah.
And so some people had the foresight to like go, hey, let's go sort through that and see if there's anything in case this movie does well that we can sell down the line in the future.
Yeah.
And so a lot of the iconic Titanic set pieces were just in a junk pile in Mexico and sold by a group of people who salvaged it. And
wow,
my wife was able to get me that piece.
That's incredible. Wow, what a story. And I'm sure it's worth something now, but also just like the, you know, the sentimental value of that. And, you know, given you love the film and that your wife went and tracked it down for you, that's incredible. Yeah. I'm sure you've probably got a few other film memorabilia, but, you know, we might have to do a separate episode to cover them all, I think.
I will happily come back. Yes. Yeah. It's been a pleasure being on your show.
Absolutely. Oh, as it has been for me as well. Yeah. Thank you, Paul. And, I guess with the film itself, like obviously it, historical in a lot of ways. I mean, it was nominated for like 14 Oscars. It won 11, one of only three films, I think, to win 11 Oscars. And yeah, it's just repeat viewings. You know, you've got the double VHS there, which I never had, but I was in the early days of bootlegging. Someone got me a copy of the movie on disc, on a CD, where someone had gone into the cinema with the big VHS cameras and had filmed the whole film, and the quality was terrible. But because the movie was in the cinemas for something like 9 months, right? Longest run of a movie in the theaters ever, I think. And then it didn't come onto video until much later. Like, I was at school when it was still in the cinema and all the girls had seen it 3 or 4 times, and I'm like, I've got it on DVD. Or on CD, and they're like, what? And can I borrow it? I'm like, no. So I used to just kind of tease them and say, yeah, I've got it. But it was so badly filmed from inside the theater. Like, there's a point where this guy gets up at, you know, the 2 hour mark of the film and walks out. I'm guessing he's going to the bathroom or something, and comes back in. And when he comes back in, he just stops and he's like in front of the screen and he's just like stretching and all the stuff, right? And you can see all this in this terrible grainy quality DVD I've got. I don't know where that ended up, but like, yeah, I thought I was kind of like, you know, Mr. Movie back then, because I had this film on DVD that was still in the cinemas and everyone was having to pay to go and watch. It's quite funny. Yeah.
I was in the same boat with Blair Witch Project.
Somebody Yeah.
Filmed Blair Witch from in the theater. So I had a really shaky version of a film that was already really shaky. But no, I'd be like, hey, you want to come over to my house after school and watch the Blair Witch Project? I got it.
Yeah. Back in those days, yeah. Definitely like the early days of bootlegging. Yeah. Terrible quality, but you know, we didn't have anything to compare it to. We were just like, yeah, this is great. Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. Just in wrapping up, Paul, I know you'll have some thoughts on this, but I like to ask some of my guests about, you know, their thoughts on, I guess, the future of movies, you know, and we're at an interesting kind of turning point with films. You know, things like Marvel have dominated for so long and they're starting to maybe drop the ball a bit. You've got, you know, a lot of films coming out of nowhere and making $1 billion, like Oppenheimer and you know, things like this, that people are sort of craving for more kind of original content and that sort of thing. And, you know, movies are competing and struggling and with things like streaming and you know, just TV shows and YouTube and all that stuff. So, yeah, your thoughts on the future of movies, what needs to happen or what would you like to see happen? You know, any thoughts on that?
Gosh, I'm kind of split on that because as a filmmaker and a screenwriter, I know that like people want to see the same thing but different. You know, it's the key to success in Hollywood is give me something that was successful just a little bit different. And you see it with, you know, there's the literal examples like how the Three Amigos and Galaxy Quest are exactly the same film, but they were both very successful. And there's also like what CGI did for filmmaking, whereas it opened a huge door and so many more possibilities, but at the same time you lose the charm of the epics, like where sets were actually built and people were there. So I think there's, you know, there's arguments for both sides of, you know, we can tell stories that people enjoy and are entertained by easier now, but it feels like the ones that are have taken more care in the storytelling and invested more in the process are the ones that have the charm that we're drawn to.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I would like to see us get back to building sets and stuff like that. I just don't think it makes sense for the studios to be spending the money when they don't need to.
Yeah.
So I'm hoping, you know, as human beings, we've been drawn to storytellers from when we were natives around a fireplace to us now just turning to our phones to tell us a story while we're on the elliptical at the gym. But I'm hoping that we are able to innovate and find new ways to tell old stories in a way that is more charming and doesn't feel as processed. I would hope that the future of storytelling brings us back to the charm and the tangible nature of, you know, being drawn into these romantic tales.
Yeah, the magic of movies. Yeah, I think it's, you still get it from time to time, but it's sort of missing a little bit. And yeah, I see where you're coming from. Like, I think certain story frameworks and character arcs and all that work time and time again, like the hero's journey, which you're probably familiar with, Harry Potter, The Matrix, Star Wars, Lord of the Rings. You know, there's a reason those are the most popular films and series of all time, because we can all relate to those characters. It's just about and being drawn, but like you said, it's the same kind of story but just set in a different world. You know, Star Wars, a lot of people argue Star Wars really ripped off Lord of the Rings because the books were written before Star Wars was made. It's kind of, you know, Frodo is Luke Skywalker and Saruman is Darth Vader, and you know, little tweaks and touches here and there. But yeah, we kind of look for those story frameworks that we know, like we can kind of predict what's going to happen, but if it can surprise us and do it in a sort of a refreshing way, then yeah, that's fine as well, I guess. Yeah, so it's a good point you make. Yeah,
and I mean, there's a lot to be said for that. Like, the most famous stories of all time all have the same kind of iconic character. There's the mentor. There's the guy who doesn't want to go on the journey, but he has to, and he has to learn along the way. And it's all a formula. It's something, one of my favorite screenwriting books is called Save the Cat. And the author, Blake Snyder, just breaks down every movie has the same formula. Every successful movie has the same formula, hits the same beats, just with different people, different characters in the roles. But so it is going to be, you know, interesting to see how that develops in the future with the ease of which CGI is making everything.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, it's an interesting time. I think, you know, it's either adapt, evolve, or vanish altogether. I hope movies don't vanish altogether. I don't think they will. That would be a very dark day in the world. Certain TV shows and reality shows can go away, but, you know, that's just me. I think movies have to stick around. But anyway, well, look, thanks, Paul. This has been a great chat. And, you know, hearing your personal stories behind each film, seeing your very cool memorabilia there, like, really cool. And getting to meet, you know, Robert Rodriguez, some really awesome stories there. And I could see, you know, your passion for these films really comes through. So thank you for being on My Movie Story. It's been a great chat.
It's been a wonderful pleasure for me as well. Thank you so much, Brian. And it's, you know, it's been a challenge to connect, but I'm glad you had the perseverance to keep it going. And this was a lot of fun. I'd be happy to come back anytime.
Fantastic. All right. All right. Thanks a lot, Paul. Take care.
Thanks.
Thanks for tuning into My Movie Story. We hope you enjoyed today's episode with our special guest and the movies that we talked about. Don't forget to hit that like button, subscribe to our YouTube channel, and follow us on Spotify or your favorite podcast platform. Your support means a lot to us. You can also stay connected with us on social media for all the latest updates and special content, and you'll find our page on Facebook. Until next time, take care and enjoy the movies. See you on the next episode.